Good afternoon, Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today's 18 May, 2024, which makes that a Saturday afternoon. We are going to finish, I hope, our immune cell biochemistry section one series with this lecture. So we've been talking about NK cells and the immediate tumor environment. And the paper we were looking at was discussing phenotypes of natural killer cells that are in that TME. And they found that the tumor resident CD103 positive NKs exhibited more co-inhibitory molecules such as TIGIT and TIM3 compared to the recruited CD103 minus NK cells. So they also suggested that chemokines like CXCL12, IP10, CCL27, and then the ILB, the interleukin-1 beta and the IL-6 were also all altered in the tumor microenvironment. And that the argument would be then, and hypothesis that could be generated, is that the tumor microenvironment reduces resident NK cell cytotoxicity and cytotoxic effector production, and therefore also its secondary ability to destroy the tumor by degranulation. So the inductive movement that one could make at this point is the tumor microenvironment reshapes, retailers NK cell phenotype at the molecular, genetic, and biochemical level. And in so doing, it alters the function to promote tumor progression. Okay. So that's kind of where we were last time. I want to tell you a little bit more about how other signaling phenomena control lymphocytic activation and subsequent ability to degrade a tumor or to inhibit an infection. So sex hormone receptors are located on T cells and B cells and on monocytes, macrophages, and dendritic cells, as well as mast cells. The NKs specifically express estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. And they will respond to estrogen via also non-estrogen receptor alpha-mediated pathways. Okay? So monocytes and macrophages have both a nuclear and a membrane estrogen receptor and androgen receptor platform complex. Now, monocyte macrophages act as antigen-presenting cells. You know that. And because they're APCs, they are particularly potent to generate that activation via the presentation of a foreign antigen. And this is often observed in the skin, the gut, the vasculature, and in various other cavities of the body, such as the peritoneum. Now, estrogen is also well known to increase antibody responses, specifically memory cell associated response to vaccines, infections, and indeed, unfortunately, autoantigens. And estrogen does this by activating the B cells, remember B lymphocytes, while androgens have absolutely the opposite effect. Now, there's a caveat there, as I always put in caveats. Depending on the context, estrogen can either promote inflammation by enhancing Th1 and or Th17 responses via transcriptional activation of the NF-kappa-B pathway, or increase the regulatory arm of the adaptive immune response by promoting tolerogenic dendritic cell anti-inflammatory regulatory Th2 type immune responses and Tregs, as well as regulating macrophage cell populations to the M2 Sequale. So estrogen and progesterone are known to enhance Treg activation. But Treg predominantly expresses estrogen receptor beta rather than alpha. That has a nuclear rather than a cell surface localization. All right, so the signal is going to be different. Now recall that prostaglandin E2 paper that we covered a while back, that we're in our synthesis now, so you have to go back and listen to that lecture. Beyond highlighting that clonal expansion and the effector differentiation of those stem-like TCF1 CD8 positive T cells occurring in the microtumor environment, it also may be possible to selectively target by a tumor-derived prostaglandin E2 generation. Right? Remember, PGE2 is generated by the cyclooxygenase activity. Now, in an intratumoral checkpoint activation that locally controls expansion and effector differentiation of cancer cell CD8 positive targetable spatiotemporal events, we have to look at a mechanism that may act in parallel to PGE2 mediated inhibition of those dendritic cells, which would otherwise support, remember, the TCF1 positive TIL responses, tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, remember TILs, within that tumor microenvironment, TME. Now, these dendritic cells, of course, as you are well aware, key orchestrators of immune responses. A specific DC subset, conventional type 1 DCs, those are the CDC1s, has been associated with human cancer patient survival in preclinical models, and it seems that these CDC1s might be critical for the spontaneous rejection of immunogenic cancers and for the ultimate success of T cell based immunotherapies. So we have to bring this into our subset of discussion. So this unique role of CDC1s reflects the ability to initiate de novo T cell responses after migrating to the tumor-draining lymph nodes, as well as attracting T cells, secreting cytokines, and presenting, this is going to be the dendritic cells, of course, tumor antigens within the TME, thus enhancing overall local cytotoxic T cell function. Okay? Now, strategies aimed at increasing CDC1 abundance in tumors and enhancing their functionality might provide an attractive way to boost anti-tumor immunity and maybe overcome some of this well-described, in fact, in my last five lectures, resistance to cancer immunotherapy. So, using an unbiased transcriptional profiling, using RNA-seq, paper that we're going to be discussing now uncovers that there's a protective anti-cancer response by that EP2, EP4. Remember, those are two receptors for the prostaglandins, prostaglandin E2. Anti-cancer responses by EP2, EP4 deficient tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. And that's all coupled to a rescue, remember, that interleukin-2 signaling, which acts as a growth factor for the TIL response. Now, studies have highlighted the relevance of IL-2 signaling, and I've discussed them before. I just want to make sure you understand IL-2 signaling is necessary and also almost at the level of sufficient to generate effective CD8 positive T cell responses from specifically antigen TCF1 positive CD8 positive T cells. Okay, so we're not dealing with subsets here. So therefore, I can say the discovery that the prostaglandin E2, EP2, EP4 axis antagonizing the responsiveness of TCF1 positive TILs to IL-2, that all necessarily becomes significant to understand the mechanistic and clinical implications involved in T lymphocytic mediated tumor ablation. Okay. Now, the results that we've been discussing here provide, with the PGE2, provided evidence that limited the proliferative capacity and hence likely the self-renewal of TCF-positive, TCF1-positive stem-like TILs, but at the same time, curbing effector T-cell generation along with the entire pathway involved in this intratumoral TIL differentiation. Because you need those TILs to differentiate, right? Of course. Now, because they're naive cells to start off with. So it may be suggested that ablation of PGE2 signaling outright and consequently a potential reconstitution we're looking to signaling would suffice to achieve the clonal TIL expansion and maybe even their effector differentiation within the tumor. And that might not be accompanied while preserving the TCF1 positive stem like TILs, right? Because these two can be differentiated. This is fundamentally different, so that you understand, to interfering with exhaustion-inducing transcription factors like the TDX and MIB, which come at the expense of TCF1 positive stem-like CD8 positive T cells, leading to, of course, what? A substantial change towards the development of the terminally differentiated, now dysfunctional T cells. So abrogating PGE2 signaling in T cells enhances clonal expansion across the entire differentiation spectrum repertoire of anti-cancer TILs. And that indicates, okay, when you weigh all this current literature discussion together, might indicate that physiological interleukin-2 concentrations within tumors could be sufficient to drive the protective anti-cancer immunity of interleukin-2 signaling in those TILs because it becomes restored. As long as you deal with the prostaglandin E2 mediated response, you see. Now remember the problem there is PGE2 is generated within the TME. Okay? So that cyclooxygenase activity itself has become a target. But you know that there's a lot of problem with that. Why is there a problem with that? Well, because PGE2 is playing multiple roles in the system. So I wanted to back up here and talk about TCF1 for a minute. TCF1, transcription factor, T cell factor 1, right? I told you before, is a pioneer transcription factor. And it works downstream from the Wnt beta-catenin signaling. And because of that, it's absolutely necessary for T cell development in the thymus, right? So, when you're talking about the function of TCF1 in T follicular helper cells and in memory T lymphocytes and in stem-like exhausted T cells where TCF1 promotes less differentiated stem-like cell states by controlling a common gene regulatory network, then you might be getting somewhere to being more concerned about TCF1. Okay. Now, all these studies so far have suggested that the mechanism of defective T cell responses in older individuals might be associated with the inability to correctly differentiate these TCF1 transcription factor dependent, less differentiated stem like T cells. Okay, so that's the important point here. What am I always saying in authentic biochemistry? Spatial temporal considerations. Spatial temporal considerations, right? Because that's where you're going to end up getting a better understanding of the overall profiling that's occurring. And targeting EP2 and EP4 on anti-cancer T cells to overcome PGE2 induced curtailing of interleukin-2 responsiveness has been suggested to be preferential over using, say, high concentrations of interleukin-2 by promoting that, because that might lead to deleterious off-target effects of interleukin-2, because you're working through the IL-2R receptor, and that can work in lung endothelial cells. It can also work in CD4-positive Tregs. Now, on that note, ablation of the PGE2, EP2, EP4 signaling axis, therefore enhancing IL-2 responsiveness in adoptively transferred cancer-specific CD8 T cells, might generate a cellular response to fully potentiate a protective anti-cancer immunity. And this is believed now to be directly associated with using cancer patient-derived TILs. Okay? So, given the association of increased cyclooxygenase-mediated prostaglandin E2 production in the tumor with cancer growth and poor survival rates in patients with cancer, this paper that was just published in May, that we're doing in the show notes, you know about this paper, seems to identify very specifically the PGE2, EP2, EP4 signaling axis in tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes as a current potential molecular target to improve T-cell immune therapy in cancer patients with tumors that have high levels of synthesis of prostaglandin E2. Okay? It's basically the outcome of that paper that we've been talking about off and on. Now, prostaglandins and thromboxane day 2 collectively are termed, of course, prostanoids, and they're formed when arachidonic acid, you know, it's 20 carbon unsaturated fatty acid, you know, it's an omega 6. Released from the plasma membrane by the phospholipases and metabolized, right, by the prostaglandin GH synthase, otherwise known as cyclooxygenase or COX, right, and all those respective synthases. Now, remember there are four principal bioactive prostaglandins generated in vivo. Prostaglandin E2, prostacyclin, which is PGI2, prostaglandin D2, and prostaglandin F2 alpha. And all four of those principal prostaglandins are ubiquitously produced in cells. Usually, each cell type generates, though, one or two dominant products. And then those prostanoids act as autocrine and paracrine lipid mediators to maintain local homeostasis. So during an inflammatory response, both the level and profile of prostaglandin production changes dramatically. And prostaglandin biosynthesis is generally very low in inflamed tissues and then increases immediately in acute inflammation. And that happens prior to the recruitment of the leukocytes and the infiltration of an immune cell like a TIL. Okay. So let me look at my time here because I'm back on this. We're doing well. We're back on the old technique for recording. Remember, the prostaglandin synthesis relies on phospholipase A2, releasing, for example, arachidonic acid, and that nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs stop the activity of cyclooxygenase, so you wouldn't synthesize PGH2, and that PGH2 is the first product of the cyclooxygenase reaction. And then there are tissue-specific isomerases. So platelets, for example, will generate TXA2. Those are the thromboxanes. Macrophages also do that, as does the kidney and the vascular smooth muscle cell. PGD2 is generated in mast cells in the brain and in airways. Now, all of the PGE2 activity moving through those four receptors, EP1, 2, 3, and 4, and then more than that, because there are over 8 splice variants involved, are significant for PGE2 metabolism, binding to the receptor, and carrying out the sequelae of that autocrine event in the brain, kidneys, also in the vascular smooth muscle cells, and again in platelets. Right? PGI2 is found in the endothelia, platelets, kidney, and brain, so there's a lot of overlap here. And finally, PGF2 alpha is very important in the eye, in the airway, in the uterus, and once again in vascular smooth muscle cells. Okay. Now, the profile of prostaglandin production is determined by the differential expression of those, all those enzymes, those isomerases, right? And that's within the specific cell types I told you about. And that's going to be present at high levels at sites of inflammation. Now, an example of that is mast cells. They predominantly generate that PGD2, while macrophages produce PGE2 and thromboxane A2. In addition to that, the alterations in the profile of prostaglandin synthesis can occur upon cellular activation. That's a TCR, for example. And resting macrophages also generate thromboxane A2 in excess, molar excess of PGE2. And that ratio between TXA2 over PGE2 changes in favor of PGE2 after bacterial lipopolysaccharide activation. So there's a great deal of crosstalk here. Now, there are prostaglandin receptors that we just talked about, the EPs. There are nicotinic acid receptors. There are platelet-activating receptors. There are succinate receptors, long-chain fatty acid receptors, proton sensors, chemoattractant receptors, and the whole LPA, sphingosine-1-phosphate, EDGE receptors, as well as indeed even endocannabinoid receptors, involved in prostaglandin signaling. So prostaglandins exert their effects by activating rhodopsin-like 7 transmembrane-spanning G-protein-coupled receptors, of course, GPCRs, and then the prostaglandin receptor subfamily sensu stricto, comprised of those 8 EP, right, because you have the splice variants. You've got the PGD receptor, and you got the FP receptor, the PGI receptor, and the thromboxane receptor, all of their own. There are also 2 additional isoforms of the TP, IP, and thromboxane. So these are scattered around different cell types. And you know, EP2 and 4 mediate a lot of T cell activity, whereas EP3 variants generated through alternative splicing actually differ because only their terminal domains, those alternative splice variants will function at multiple receptor sites. So they're more generic. Then you have chemokine receptors like the CRTH2, which is actually a member of the FMLP1 chemoattractant receptor superfamily. Okay, so I want you to understand that once prostaglandins come into play, there are literally, I would say, close to 100 different types of receptors. I just went through them with you. Proton sensors, chemoattractant receptors, lysophosphatidic acid, sphingosine-1-phosphate receptors, endocannabinoid receptors, prostaglandin receptors, sensu stricto, and then those lipid nucleotide receptors we started to get into, GPCRs. Okay, you understand? And there's also some sensu stricto nicotinic acid receptors that function through prostaglandin metabolism. All right. So, and they change once bound to the receptor, those five or so prostaglandins, TXA2, PGD2, E2, I2, and F2 alpha, are going to be having working through their different subsets of those receptors, are going to be working through different G protein coupling mechanisms, and working through those different G protein coupled mechanisms, what else is going to happen? Well, you know, you're going to have an effect downstream from mediating all those responses. For example, what? Increases in diacylglycerol, calcium, Rho, GEF, alterations in cyclic AMP, alterations in calcium mobilization, and all of these are going to be coupled to the unique reception of those different subtypes of those given prostanoid receptors in specific cell and tissue types, activating and co-activating, occurring in a way that generates a network of phenomena that can change based on the valence, that is the weighting of the receptor-mediated response, thus controlling overall the immune response. That's why it's so important to understand how the immune system is, you know, and I know that I'm a lipid biochemist, it sounds like I'm always saying this, but the immune response is really controlled by lipid metabolism. All the different lipid components that are acting as signaling molecules and as endomembranous regions coordinating the movement of those receptors and other polypeptides that work either a priori or a posteriori to the initial signaling event. So that's the real take-home message I wanted to make with that. I think pretty much we can close this lecture off. I was going to talk more about cyclooxygenases and how nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs control their activity, because there is some very important distinction between, for example, ibuprofen-mediated responses and acetylsalicylic acid. And you know, acetylsalicylic acid is essentially a suicide inhibitor because you get an acetylation of the enzyme, whereas ibuprofen is not. And that's one reason. So there's a difference in the mechanism of inhibition of the cyclooxygenase. But because of that, many downstream events are affected. And that's what was really significant relative to the potency of the prostaglandins through all that different reception we went through. So last minute or so, I just want to say that we're going to end now this first glance at immune cell biochemistry, specifically looking at how immune cells respond to signaling, bioenergetic, cell fate decision, as well as all the effector phenomena that happen a priori and a posteriori to the initial, if it was a T lymphocyte like we were talking about, to the initial T cell receptor induction via the presentation of antigen from an APC. So I think next time I might do a metaphysical lecture. I'm thinking about it because I want to take a break from all this. I know there's been a great deal of information that I've been presenting to you over the last, 24, 25 lectures. And I want that to sink in so that some questions can be derived from the audience. And at that same time, I'm writing the lectures that are going to lead into B cells, because I want to start talking about B cells now, because we need to bring that into the fore of immune cell biochemistry. Okay. All right. And like I said, next time, maybe the next two lectures, it'll be more on metaphysics, epistemology of biochemistry. Okay. Still biochemistry. So this is your professor, Dr. Dan Guerra, coming to you from Authentic Biochemistry Podcast Studios in the beautiful inland Northwest on a sunny Saturday afternoon, saying bye for now.